SalesApe, the AI sales rep built to give small businesses the unfair advantage of closing more deals. If you generate over 50 leads a month but can't reply instantly, you lose deals. SalesApe will be your hidden superpower. Used by hundreds of real estate agents, construction companies, and service providers, and backed with $20 million from top investors. SalesApe is doubling sales for hundreds of businesses just like you. Your own AI agent instantly qualifies inbound leads, engages high-intent buyers, and books appointments 24/7, even when your team's off the clock. More sales, less overhead. Sales on autopilot. Go to salesape.ai/podcast to try their free demo. Again, that's salesape.ai/podcast for a free demo.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa, got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments, Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels, Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch, a podcast of stories from women leaders who are shaping our world today. I'm particularly excited about my guest this week. Shalonda Armstrong recently launched a venture capital firm. And in light of the uncertainty of our economy right now, she has some great tips for what we should be thinking about and perhaps investing in. Don't forget to stay with us during the breaks where you'll hear from our watch team of corporate partners. And please do subscribe to our YouTube channel at W2W Media. So now I'm excited to welcome to the show, Shalonda Armstrong. Shalonda, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you. I'm excited for this interview because one of the things I love about what you're doing is that you're getting women and young girls excited about finance. And, you know, it's something we talk about on the show quite often, and you're actually doing something about it. And not only that, I think from a very young age, you knew that finance was going to be your arena. So I thought I would start with the story of you buying your first stock at 11 years old. That's pretty unique.
Yeah. I'm originally from the Midwest, born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. And I have a sister who is 12 years older. And so she had just recently returned back from undergrad, and she was working for a financial services institution. And she introduced me to a woman in her office. Her name was Gail Perry Mason. And for those who are familiar with the Metro Detroit, she's very well known for kind of her impact that she's had on youth and just really helping us understand financial literacy. And when I was introduced to her, she was at the time just coming up with a concept of how to get young people introduced to stocks and getting them interested in the stock market. Now, note, this is also, you know, mid-90s. So this is also just a different time period, right? We didn't have the online platforms that we have today. And so you really did have to call your stockbroker. There was a fee. There's all these things tied to it, and access was very, very different back then. And so just being able to buy my first shares of Converse at the time, it was 80 shares of Converse. And to have that exposure so young changed my relationship around money and how I thought about money. And it put me in this completely different mindset around how I thought about ownership, how I thought about investing, and immediately removed any of those barriers with, you know, money being scary or an uncomfortable conversation to have.
Did it help you as well to, I mean, 11 years old, it's really young. And I'm impressed that you paid attention to your older sister, you know, and what she was trying to teach you. That doesn't always happen. But did it kind of motivate you to think about your future? Because, you know, outside of investing, first we need to save, right? There needs to be money there to invest.
Absolutely. So my parents were always very, very adamant from a very young age about teaching us the importance of saving. And I remember many conversations with my father and being very upset as a kid because, you know, as you're earning, you know, dollars, whether it's from birthdays or achievements, you're earning money and then you want to go buy things because you're a kid and you're seeing things that you want to buy, whether it's on TV or things like that. And he would always tell me, if you cannot buy it twice, you can't afford it.
And I've never heard that before.
Yeah, that was always his mantra. You can't buy it twice, you can't afford it. And it was something that I hated hearing growing up. I will tell you now, as a woman in her 40s, that is the best advice he ever gave me because it is very true. And it's not talked about enough around really understanding what you can afford, your relationship with money, and just all the nuances around when you want something versus a need, but then also evaluating, can you truly afford it?
Yeah, I think it's interesting too that your parents really had these conversations with you around money. I don't know that that's always the case. It might be more so today, but my generation, no one talked about money. You know, we went to school and learned math, but really not learning about life, right? And what it takes. Were you introduced to any of that in your schooling, in your younger years?
I was. I remember in elementary school, I believe around somewhere around the second or third grade, we would have the local bank branches come into the school and help us set up, at the time, our savings accounts, right? And so that is how I first got exposure to understanding. Of course, when you're in elementary school, you learn how to count money, but also just being exposed of banking access. And so that is where I learned to save. And of course, when you, and again, this is at a time where we didn't have language to it, but when you put gamification against trying to help young kids understand how to save, it incentivizes them. And so essentially that's what they were doing. And you don't want to be the kid who shows up to school and you don't have like $5 to put in your savings account and everyone else is going to be able to do that. So you start figure out like, no, I want to make sure I'm saving too. I don't want to be left behind. And that's kind of how it rewires your brain.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, how did your Converse stocks do?
Did really well for a moment. Me and my mother still go back and forth about this. It did really well. And then I wanted to sell it because it was doing well. And my parents are, you know, again, they're teaching me the philosophy of long-term investing. They go, no, you don't sell, you hold on. Well, we held on a little too long. And then eventually, you know, Converse was acquired by Nike and everything else. So held on a little too long. There's also an investing lesson in that, but well for a while. Absolutely.
Yeah. I know you were an athlete growing up as well. Tell me how sports, you know, shaped the way you think about business and your company.
Yeah, I would say it was, again, one of these things that you don't realize in the moment as you're going through it, but the involvement in sports really taught me a different level of resiliency that was important as I was entering into my adult years. And that is, you know, being comfortable with no, being comfortable with failure, and always trying to figure out, okay, how to get better. And so that was one of the things with sports that I appreciated so much. And I definitely lean on those experiences every day because it was so valuable, but also when you're a kid, you don't realize that that's what it's preparing you for.
Right. You look back and see it. Tell me what is a challenge that you faced growing up? I know, you know, you had supportive, loving parents and, you know, you had a great upbringing. What was something that was challenging for you that perhaps you have overcome or still have to work on today?
I think one of the things that was challenging for me is I was actually from this major city that was known at one time as the Paris of the Midwest, and it was going through a transition. And that transition, I was growing up in the middle of it, and it was difficult to really figure out what was like outside of the state of Michigan and the city of Detroit. And for a long time, the city of Detroit, you know, the automotive industry really was a staple in the US. And then as it was transitioning into a different phase, there's a lot of limiting beliefs that come into that from just an environment standpoint. And so one of the challenges that I constantly had to push myself was past of, no, there is more than just whatever I'm in, whatever environment I'm in, right? There's always more. And also getting comfortable with the pivot. And that is one of the things that I always say I will accredit to growing up in Detroit, was as they were trying to navigate their own pivot, it also taught me how to think about and navigate the pivots that you have to endure, honestly, in life.
Yeah. Tell me about your love of space.
Yes. So, again, young, I was part of this group, and I believe it was nationally at the time in the 90s, called Young Astronauts. And it was one of the early STEM programs, getting kids who were interested in space exposure to kind of what it would take to be an astronaut. And so I was part of that program through all of my elementary years. I actually had the opportunity to go to space camp, which was a awesome experience as a kid. And it is absolutely one of the things that I love. And it was also my introduction into the world of engineering that I eventually found myself into as an adult as well.
Would you say you were one of few girls there in space camp, or was it a nice mix of boys and girls?
Great question. I was one of a few, handful of girls. And at the time I didn't recognize it.
Good for you.
Yeah. At the time, yeah, I didn't recognize it, but yeah, there wasn't a ton of girls that were interested in space or at science at that time. And I think it was just, they may have just not known what was possible at the time. And so one of the things I love to see today is there's so many girls that are interested in engineering and the sciences and space. And we've just recently saw, women go to the, get to the Kármán line, I'll say.
Yeah, right. What's your take on that? That was, an interesting event. And again, I think, the saying, if you can't see it, you can't be it. And so showing girls what can be and come of their life. There was a little pushback about that trip. And what's your take on it?
I am choosing to take to look at it from a positive standpoint, and that there was some little girl who either saw that mission or will see that mission in the future and think bigger and dream bigger. And so that is what I'm choosing to lean into, because you just never know how those things plant a seed in someone else and how it motivates them to do something.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, the name of your company, 100KM, has to do with space.
It does.
Right? Tell us what it means.
Yeah. So 100KM Ventures, we're an early stage venture capital firm. And the story behind the name is the distance between sea level and the Kármán line, which is where the latest mission went to, and that's technically the beginning of outer space, is 62 miles. 62 miles translates to 100 kilometers, and so that is the origin between the name of 100 km, because we're pushing the boundaries of what's possible for our founders.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to go into our first break, and when we come back, I want to hear the kind of the origin story of your company and where you were when the idea came to you.
Absolutely.
Stay with us as we go into our break, where you'll hear from our corporate partners and Watch team, bringing you some news and information from their industries. And we'll be back with Shalonda Armstrong.
SalesApe, the AI sales rep built to give small businesses the unfair advantage of closing more deals. If you generate over 50 leads a month but can't reply instantly, you lose deals. SalesApe will be your hidden superpower. Used by hundreds of real estate agents, construction companies, and service providers, and backed with $20 million from top investors. SalesApe is doubling sales for hundreds of businesses just like you. Your own AI agent instantly qualifies inbound leads, engages high-intent buyers, and books appointments 24/7, even when your team's off the clock. More sales, less overhead. Sales on autopilot. Go to salesape.ai/podcast to try their free demo. Again, that's salesape.ai/podcast for a free demo.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa, got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments, Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels, Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
As a female-led organization, you have to bring it every single day. We're a mashup of sort of right and left brain. So we're not just doing management consulting. We're not just doing creative services. We're not just producing an event, but we're bringing a comprehensive solution to our clients. And because of the way we approach it, we end up being bought into what it is that we're doing in a way that we truly have as much skin in the game as our clients do, whether it's bringing affordable internet to communities across the Caribbean, or it's helping Comcast with their Internet Essentials program, which is something we've been very proud to work on, or it's helping the NFL celebrate their centennial season by getting 1 million people to give at least 100 minutes to causes they care about, or helping the city of Philadelphia win the World Cup. So what's next for us? Well, we just hit just over 100 employees. I think we are at that tipping point, and I don't think there's anybody that does it better than we do. I'm Maggie Wilkinson, CEO of Athena Global Advisors, a company that is proudly based in Philadelphia.
Hi, I'm Katie Gore, the president of Quidel Consulting and Training. There are a lot of myths about affordable housing and the people who need and live in affordable housing. One myth, for example, only people who are unemployed need and live in affordable housing. The reality is that many people in affordable housing actually have working full-time jobs. Teachers, healthcare workers, service employees, people who are essential in our communities. They often struggle to afford rent in so many communities across the nation. And that's what's the beauty about affordable housing. They are providing work in the communities at an affordable rent. Another myth is that affordable housing increases crime. Studies consistently show there is no link between affordable housing and increased crime. In fact, stable housing can reduce crime by providing security and fostering stronger community neighborhoods and building attachment for the people who live in affordable housing. For more information about affordable housing and to walk through some more of those myths, you can find me and my segment on the Women to Watch platform.
Welcome back to the show. I'm speaking this week with Shalonda Armstrong, and Shalonda is the founder of 100KM Ventures, a venture fund that I'll say is really for quite a diverse group of people, which we certainly need, you know, in this world today, particularly women, I would say. Tell me, so it's a big risk to start a company like this. And I wonder where you were when the idea came to you. And tell me a little bit about how it got started.
Absolutely. So I was first introduced to venture in 2003. And I was an undergrad at Hampton University. I was a computer science major, and I was building this code, and we're creating this program. And then a press release comes through. And at the time, the Facebook had just secured venture capital dollars to continue scaling. And I'm talking to my classmates, and I'm like, why are we doing this? And of course, my classmates are like, oh yes, we have to do a startup, and everyone's thinking about a startup. And I saw the name Peter Thiel. And I said, no, how do I become him? He's the one that gave the money. And that is when I was introduced to this niche industry of venture capital. And I realized as I did more research and I learned more about it, it was very, very small. At the time, there was not that many venture capital firms. Venture was not a known asset class the way it is known today. And so I wanted to figure out, all right, how do I do that? And what's the best way to position myself to launch a firm and invest in early stage technology companies? And so I kind of curated a career from a technical standpoint, as well as strategic and operational experience through a lot of great employers that I had a chance to work for. And once I had obtained kind of all the success I was looking for from a big corporate standpoint, it was time to really do what I wanted to always do. And that was to launch a firm. And so I had already been an angel investor for over a decade. I've been invested in over 30 plus companies. I was an LP myself in a few VC funds. And so I decided to just take the leap to manage institutional capital, because for me, not trying is worse than failing. And so that is what I decided to lean into.
Shalonda, what do you think is behind your drive? You know, when you ask that question about, you know, I want to be that guy, what keeps you driving and motivated?
I have not figured that quite out yet.
You've been too busy to reflect.
Well, you know, it's you know, just wanting to experience life. I get one go at this. And so I really try to speak with myself as much as I can and really reflect on what is it that I want to do. If you could live life uninterrupted, what would you do? And so that is what I choose to lean into and just go pursue those things. Because when it's all said and done, I want to look back and said, at least I did it all. And I left no plays, you know, left. Like I left it all on the field. So that's kind of what keeps me motivated.
Yeah, all on the field, right?
Yeah, you gotta leave it out there.
Yeah. I have a quote. You said women are often over-mentored and under-sponsored. And so we're trying to make sure that we're closing that gap. How are you doing that?
That is a great question, also really complicated to answer. So one of the things that I try to do is I try to really lean into how can I be helpful to whether it's founders, my investors, other co-investors that I may have, because that is where you really are able to find community. And what I've noticed is that we are starting to find ourselves in this space where women are having to pay for community. And it is because we're always just trying to find like-minded individuals. And I want to figure out how to remove some of those barriers, because community shouldn't have to be paid for. And men have community for free, but for women, we have to pay for it. And so, and that's because sometimes we don't know how to lean in and just say, how can I be helpful to you? Like, what can I do to help you move the needle? And it may be a huge ask, maybe a little ask, but how I will at least want to put it out there. How can I be helpful? And what can I do to help support?
How would you describe how women invest differently than men? What do you see?
I notice that women are definitely much more conservative. They're definitely like to take more calculated risk. And that could be for so many reasons. However, women are also very much, once they're committed, they want to lean in and they want to be helpful. And that is what we've seen in the data. And I think this is why data has shown that women tend to be better investors, because once they truly are committed and have conviction about an investment, they absolutely lean in. Where I think men absolutely are more open to risk. And sometimes, you know, they do treat it as gambling at times, where I think women really treat it more as a commitment that they're making with their dollars.
Do you see that changing? You know, in the work that you're doing, you're seeing firsthand. And I would say that's so very true from years ago. But as more women see other women doing it, do you find that they're becoming more eager to get involved and take risks?
Absolutely. Because I think it's shifting around how women think about trying to show or display wealth. And so, you know, historically, women have thought about the fancy bag or the car or the really nice clothes, and that was a status symbol for them. I think women are now shifting into a mindset that men often have had, is wealth is really shown by ownership, assets, the things that are not visible, but you're able to speak about. And that is what I believe women are starting to understand and lean into more as they're having more conversations with other like-minded women around, okay, how do we actually grow and compound around our wealth and how to grow our wealth?
Tell me if someone's listening or watching and they're getting excited about it and they want to get involved, what is your advice for them to find the arena that they want to invest in? What kind of questions can they ask themselves about where they want to participate?
Absolutely. I'll speak kind of from the venture lens. So if you find yourself as an accredited investor and you're thinking about, hey, do I want to start investing in venture capital and these early stage startups? What does that look like? I always encourage folks, especially women, find community. There are a ton of women-led angel groups that will take you through the education of understanding the asset class that you're investing in, that you can also share deals with. They will help with due diligence. And it also just helps you understand the nuance of the asset class and get you comfortable with taking that first step of writing that check to a very, you know, early stage company that you are really have a lot of conviction in that they can scale and grow into something significant.
And how about if you don't have a significant amount of money? I would imagine, you know, people have a number in their head. Oh, I don't have enough. What is that number that is actually you can see some success from, but perhaps not believe it is enough?
Sure. So if you find yourself like, hey, you're not quite at that accredited investor status, but you do want to start investing, I would definitely encourage you to just take your first $100, right, that you may have spent on a bag, or you might want to, you know, spend on a fancy dinner, and set up a brokerage account. And then just start with a S&P 500 ETF. There's VOO, SPY, and just start there and work your way up to buying one share, and then just start to compound after that. And once you buy that one share, there is going to be something that unlocks in you of, at least I took the first step. And then you're like, okay, let me buy one more. And then you're going to say, all right, maybe I want to buy individual stock. And then you're thinking about individual stocks. Think about where you spend your money. right? How much do you spend on Amazon? How much Netflix do you watch? How much time do you spend on social media platforms? So think about how you're spending your time and your money, and then start evaluating those companies and figuring out how to put your capital into buying shares of those companies. And then again, now you have ownership of the things that you are spending your money and your time with.
Yeah. $100 seems doable. That's not a massive amount of money. It's probably, if you add up the daily things, the coffees, right, that you get out, how much time do you spend and do you teaching women the, you know, financial literacy?
Yeah, I would say I spend a good amount of time, not necessarily teaching financial literacy, but just creating a space for us to have conversations about money. So it may be around investing. It may be around taxes. It may be around, hey, I'm thinking about how to even just set up, just think about like how to navigate this macro environment that we're in, interest rates. And how do I need to think about the time value of money, because the dollar is not worth as much as it was worth yesterday, right? And so I would say I spend a good amount of time having those conversations with women and creating a safe space to ask those questions. I think one thing that has happened historically is when women would speak up and have those questions, if they were in rooms with men, those questions were often dismissed and not validated. And so women started to kind of shy away from having those conversations. And I want to make sure that I'm always creating a space for us to have these open conversations, because money is not taboo. It's not a taboo topic. It's a necessary topic that we need to have healthy conversations around. And even as navigating their relationship with money, being open and honest about that. Because when you share your truth around how you view money, or how you have a complicated relationship with money, that helps another woman with her journey of how she's thinking about money as well.
Do you have a vision, a goal, or a dream for yourself? If you get to a level of attaining a certain amount of wealth, something that, you know, where you would want to have some impact?
That's a great question. I think I'm living out the first part of that dream, and that would be having more women introduced to the venture asset class, because there's so much opportunity there, and allowing women to be able to have exponential wealth invested in this asset class. I think from there, I absolutely have aspirations to do more around supporting women and helping them with financial literacy. I just haven't been able to kind of figure out what that next looks like. But I know that there's something else after just launching the firm and having a franchise of funds.
Right. It's going to evolve, right? Your life is constantly evolving. And I would say in today's climate, right, the economy, everyone is a little bit on edge. Everything is very uncertain. How would you speak to that and where people's mindset should be in order to continue to make decisions for themselves financially?
Absolutely. I would always tell everyone that in the midst of chaos, there's always opportunities. And so pay attention to where there's an opportunity and lean into that. When we see the public markets unstable as they've been recently, investors tend to want to retreat. Well, this is actually the time to find opportunities and lean in. Wealth is made in downturns, it's collected in the up markets though. And that is one of the things that's not talked about enough, is this is when wealth is actually created. When everyone is running scared, this is when, and traditionally we've seen it, men who are sophisticated investors always double down at these times. And then once everything is up and to the right and everyone feels good because the markets are up, that is when wealth is actually collected.
Shalonda, thank you so much for joining me this week to share a bit of your story. I think you're doing really great and important work for women.
Thank you so much. I love the conversation. It's great talking to you.
Awesome. Stay with me as we go into our last break, and I'll be back to close out the show.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 companies through my work at the EXCO Group, a firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior executives grow. Today, I'd like to speak about how to deal with a toxic work environment. While there are some well-documented cases of blatantly toxic cultures, toxicity in the workplace is often a more subtle nature, which can even be more dangerous to one's mental health and well-being. So how can one deal with a toxic relationship? While the path of least resistance may be avoidance, this isn't the healthiest of approaches, as odds are the negative behavior is often not just towards one person, but anyone that the person may perceive as a threat. As difficult as it may be, I encourage having a direct conversation. Plan and rehearse what you want to say. Be sure to stay diplomatic, but stand strong and be sure to address your concerns in a clear and concise manner. And in return, be ready to listen to what the other person has to say. Remember, no one has the right to make you feel uncomfortable in the workplace. Have another person moderate the conversation if needed. Also, escalate if there's no resolution. Looking back, perhaps the biggest mistake I made early on in my career as a new leader was tolerating poor behavior from one individual because I thought he was so smart and so invaluable to the company. What I failed to recognize was the mental and productivity impact that his behavior was having on the team as a whole. I didn't fire him, although the next manager did. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, visit excoleadership.com to learn more.
Over on our Women to Watch YouTube channel, we have a partner profile series featuring some of the amazing executive women working at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Our latest installment features Dr. Susan Firth. Here's an excerpt from our latest conversation. The goal, I would say, of CHOP is for every child to have a chance at a healthy future. And how does the Research Institute specifically support and help in that goal?
One of our strategic imperatives as an enterprise is to really promote research-driven precision medicine, you know, so diagnostics and therapeutics that are really tailored to an individual's circumstance. And I always add to that research-driven precision medicine that this has to be research-driven precision medicine for everyone. So we've invested in programs around health equity, research methods, and making sure that as we are pursuing our research and discovery, that we're thinking about how our questions apply to different populations, whether it's where they live, if they're rural or urban, or what their social determinants of health are. So we're trying to incorporate thinking broadly about improving child health to all populations. So we want to help children who are around the world and also in our backyard.
To learn more about Dr. Susan Firth, head over to our Women to Watch YouTube channel for the full interview.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first-of-its-kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thanks so much for joining me. Next week, I'll be speaking with Erin Lyons, and Erin is the co-founder of Power Poker. She's a strategic advisor who works with Fortune 500 executives using poker to help them with their strategies. Really interesting. If you've received our newsletter, you may have seen that we are struggling a little bit this year to get some sponsors on board. I really do want to keep this show going. So if you're interested in learning more, please feel free to reach out to me directly. You can email me at susan@womentowatch.net. Thank you, as always, to our current sponsors for helping us to bring you the show each and every week. And I will see you next time.